All right, it's the Steve Cochran Everything Podcast. Gee, this is your first podcast. How do you feel?
I feel great.
Okay, I'm glad you're here.
Really important topic.
This is a really important topic. Let me introduce the guests. Renee Bernberg Silberman is here. Joe Silberman is here. Jed Silberg is here. No relation. Jed, let me start with you for a second, because, and get right into that microphone for me. You have an event coming up, the Chicago Holocaust Museum, this, of course, benefits the National Holocaust Museum as well. Talk to me about the event and how we get tickets.
Right. So this is to benefit the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in D.C., our Midwest regional office here in Chicago. It's put on this event. This will be the—I had to count it up. This will be the 24th luncheon that we do here in Chicago. This next event is September 9th at the Sheraton downtown, and we would love to have as many people who are listening come and check us out. You can find more information about the event at ushmm.org, which is our website. And this year's speaker is noted Holocaust historian and real expert on anti-Semitism, Professor Deborah Lipstadt. So we're very much looking forward to having
her. And Renee, talk about Deborah for a second. What do we need to know?
Well, Deborah is a professor in Atlanta, and she actually was involved with the case of a Holocaust denier in England, but her latest book is called Anti-Semitism, and it is an excellent, excellent analysis of how anti-Semitism started, why it still exists today. And the voice that she speaks in her book is as a professor speaking to a Jewish student on campus, as well as a colleague who is not Jewish on campus, who are saying to her, why is this anti-Semitism getting worse? Haven't we evolved past this? And so she tries to break down the elements of anti-Semitism and what people need to be aware of going forward. So she's going to be very interesting in person because, of course, she doesn't divulge all the secrets in the book.
And she's not too academic, right? So people can wrap their head around it?
Very easy to understand the book. And I'm sure she will be very easy to understand in person. So she's a huge draw for the luncheon. She'll be very interesting.
Well, I salute you for the work you do every day. But getting to this is always a big effort every year, I know. And it's an important one. So people need to support it. Joe, what's a child of survivors? I want to make sure I have the term right.
Right. 2G, child of survivors.
Child of survivors. Describe it.
Well,
define it, I guess, is a better
define
word.
Define it. Well, the definition of it is if one or both of your parents survived the Holocaust. So surviving can be anything from surviving a concentration camp, being hidden during the war, being in a convent, being hidden during the war. There's lots of different things that constitute being a survivor. But someone who is an offspring of that survivor would be a second generation.
And how many folks that would fit under that category do we have active in the movement to educate?
How many
we talking hundreds, children of survivors, hundreds, thousands? I mean, do we know?
I don't think we know, because not every child of a survivor has come out and identified themselves as such. I will tell you that in the Chicago area, we have a Daughters of Survivors group that has about 250 women on the mailing list, but that doesn't mean that there aren't 1,000 Daughters of Survivors in the Chicagoland area. We've just identified, or they've self-identified as that. So children of survivors, I'm sure it's in the thousands across the country.
It's got to be in the thousands.
Well, we talked about this before, I think. I don't want to get G in here on this, but the idea that you would step back into the fire where there's so much pain and be able to talk about it is amazing to me. So speak to you a little bit about your personal family story, Renee.
Well, both my parents were survivors. My father's story is a little simpler. He left his town as a 20-year-old, trained as an accountant, joined the Russian army to fight the Nazis that way. And oftentimes, Jews were put on the front lines in those battles. And he, as an accountant, went to his supervising officer and said, there's a better way to handle rations, there's a better way to handle logistics, so let me help you. And they took him away from the front lines and put him in the quartermaster's office, and that's how he survived the war. But he was the only member of his family that survived the war. My mother was actually hidden by a Polish Catholic woman who lived on a farm not far from my mother's town. And so the the bulk of the identity that I have as a child of survivors comes from my mother's story, because it was the easiest story to convey to our children, because it did have elements of the horrors of Nazi occupation, but also the element of hope, because her life was saved by a Polish Catholic woman.
Well, they're both amazing stories. Just, I mean, gee, jump in here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking about how, for better or for worse, we as children of our parents carry on their legacy, and then also their traumas and happiness. And I can only imagine, as children of survivors, it completely alters your childhood, knowing that that's what your parents survived. So if you could describe a little bit the sense of enormity that you felt in carrying on their story and their legacy. I'm sure it's a different type of childhood even for yourself.
Well, I would say growing up, we knew our parents had accents, and we knew we didn't have an extended family. And that's probably the first thing that we knew. We didn't have grandparents or aunts or uncles or cousins. It was just our parents, and we were the youngest, so we had older siblings, whereas our friends from school had all these big extended families. So it starts out that way, kind of knowing that your core family is it. And you want to
say something? Well, then there are stories I can relay where I can remember vividly walking down the street with my father. He's holding my hand, and I happen to turn around to look at something behind me, and he pulls on my hand and says, "Never look backwards. Never look behind you. Always look forward." And I thought to myself, I was like 6 years old at the time, and I thought to myself, well, that's weird. And then later on, right, I came to realize, okay, this guy was always running. He was always looking out for himself. He never wanted to, you know, look backwards. He was going somewhere
looking
else.
Looking back at me, you're dying.
Yeah, exactly.
So how old are you when you both find out at least the beginnings of the truth about what their lives were?
Well, both of my parents didn't really talk about it much. They were older. So the older Holocaust generation really didn't talk about it much. It wasn't until Steven Spielberg came around in the 90s with the Shoah Foundation that Holocaust survivors really began opening up and realizing that they should really talk about it. So my parents' generation did not do that. So I was probably in my early teens. I went to Jewish school growing up, so I knew about the Holocaust. And I knew my parents only spoke Yiddish to me, and I spoke back to them in English. And I realized I was different. Like Renee said, I only had my two older brothers and my two parents. I had no cousins. I had no grandparents. All my friends did. So I knew I was different some way. But it wasn't until I was in my early teens I realized my parents are acting weird in certain instances. And obviously, I put two and two together. I realized why. I couldn't ask them what was going on, because I did try one time to ask my father a question, and he got really upset. And I didn't want to get him upset.
Of course
not. He already had, you know, upset in his life, so I wasn't going to go there. So I just didn't ask anymore.
As a boy becoming a man, I can't imagine the anger for your parents, especially to begin to understand the history of the Holocaust.
Well, it was interesting. My parents never really showed anger towards other people, which I thought was interesting, because I would have a lot of anger built inside me, but my parents weren't like that. They were reserved, and so I didn't really feel anger necessarily, because I didn't really know their stories per se. So I couldn't really put a finger on why I would be angry.
Do you think that was intentionally modeled that way for your own good, or were they just good people?
I would think that they just didn't want to have me think that something evil could happen to them the way it did. So they were probably trying to just shelter
me. That's good people.
Yeah. That would have been a lot of pressure on you as a child.
I would think so.
Renee, how old were you when you found what you found out?
Okay, well, the first thing I want to say is I think it's different for older children of survivors, like the firstborns or secondborns, than it is for the youngest, because the firstborns may have been born in Europe before the parents left the displaced persons camps. They were around when the parents were learning a new language, adjusting to the culture of the United States, trying to find work and, you know, start trying to become normal Americans. So I think the experience for the older children is different than for the younger. By the time I came around, my parents just wanted me to be a normal American girl who played with Barbies. And so they didn't ever tell me anything specific, But the woman who saved my mother's life came to Chicago and stayed in our house starting from the time I was about five, because she first came for my older brother's bar mitzvah.
Okay.
And he's 8 years older than me. So I knew this was a woman who saved my mother's life during the war, but I didn't know the details of what my mother had, what she had seen, what she had lost, and what the woman, whose name is Marisha, what she had done to save my mother. I would say, also, I went to Hebrew school. I learned about the Holocaust, didn't know their specific story. And then in the 90s, that's when everybody started talking, and that's when I was at the age, well, I would say more the 80s for me, actually, because the woman who saved my mother was honored by Yad Vashem as righteous among the nations for saving a Jewish life. She actually saved four people. And that's when I had to learn the story, because I was the master of ceremonies of that medal ceremony. So I read the document that was written and submitted to Yad Vashem that detailed how she saved the four Jewish lives.
Wow.
And then the backstory came out in the 90s. So that's when my mother told me about how she grew up, what her life was like, what her parents were like, the kind of school she went to.
Well, it's almost like you're reading a diary that you have been given access to. So I can't imagine how moving that must have been for you in a million different ways.
In a million different ways. And I'll tell you two more quick stories.
Sure.
There was a researcher at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum who was doing research on my father's hometown in Poland before the war. When the museum was collecting artifacts, one of the things my father had donated was a picture of himself as a child with his family in the town. So she had seen that my father was from this town. She called and asked if she could get more information of his life before the war. Well, my father was very sick at that time. So I sat down with him and I interviewed him. And that's when I learned all these things about my father, what his school life was for, and how he skied and how he played with his friends. So I never would have done that on my own because, like Joe said, our parents, we knew, went through loss and suffered. We didn't want to bring that up for them. But here I was tasked to do that, so I took that opportunity to do it, and it was wonderful connecting with him and learning all that.
I can't imagine your father skiing.
No,
I just cannot picture that.
I can't either. But he did. I mean, he was a normal guy, and then the war happened.
Right, so, and everything changed.
Right.
I mean, I think one of the big concerns is that the survivors aren't around anymore to tell their stories. And then you've stepped in as the second generation to continue that legacy. What do you worry about in terms of passing that on to the third generation? And, of course, we're under a sense of urgency, as Steve was saying. We were talking earlier.
Hatred is very much a topic of the day.
Yeah.
And how we're tearing each other apart at a time where we need to be together more than ever.
Do you worry about that sense of, you know, closeness, because you knew your parents very well, being lost, as you pass it on to your next generation, and then also making sure that sense of urgency exists for them?
It does get diluted over the generations, certainly. Without the survivors there to see and hear, you know, it's harder to convey that full essence of what they went through. But I think what will happen over the generations, hopefully in a positive way, is that you can't forget what happened to not just my parents, but to a whole generation of people. And the kind of hatred that did exist in that time can't happen again. We just can't forget that ever happened, and hopefully instill in people not letting that happen. And it's educating people and allowing them to learn the signs of what happens in a society when things start breaking down from the top down, and viewing those signs and having, you know,
taking them seriously
and doing something about it. You can't just sit there and watch it happen. Because that's what happened in Germany.
So what is your, and any of you guys take this, what is your sense of optimism or pessimism about where we are and where we're headed?
It's a tough one because we want to remain optimistic about human nature, but human nature can go either way. Now, the more educated people, I think that they know that this is a dangerous path that we're on. They know that our country is divided. They know that something has to give. I think there's still a large portion of people who are not educated, who don't know the other, and just think the worst of the other, whatever that other may be. So we have to be relentless in educating people wherever that is, whether it's, you know, a poster on a subway train or at a bus station or through the media. We have to be positive and give positive educational messaging and show examples of diversity.
Sure.
There has to be diversity in the workplace. There has to be a sense of diversity in our communities.
How do you get that messaging to the people that need it the most, who probably aren't going to be as accessible to those messages, right? But those are the folks
we're
that maybe...
Yeah. Yeah. What I would say, institutionally, the U.S. Holocaust Museum thinks about these questions daily, right? I think Joe and Renee have both done a great job painting the picture of four different Holocaust survivors. There were many, many more victims. We talk about 6 million victims, 6 million Jewish victims, and millions more who were killed by the Nazis. Those are really huge numbers and hard to grasp. But what we do institutionally is we try to make those stories human. We try to put a human face on what happened. And most importantly, what we try to do is show that the unthinkable, the Holocaust, the greatest mass murder in the history of humankind, can actually happen, right? We have the foresight now of knowing that if we go down these roads and we don't have civic society and social institutions that are stopping them and people speaking up for the other, we have the hindsight of knowing what can happen if hatred goes unchecked.
Is there a difference between never forget and always remember? Because I almost feel like we're sliding into a time where always remember, even though it's painful, is more important. Never forget, it's two very important words, but it also sort of, it's going to put it on the back shelf. We're going to take it out when we need it. I feel like we need to remember, you know, and I'll give you an example. 9/11, you go to the 9/11 Museum in New York City, incredibly moving. And there's a sense that, well, this happened to all of us. Well, I wasn't alive during World War II, but guess what? This happened to all of us. The Holocaust happened to the world.
Yep.
And sometimes I feel like it's seen as, oh, it's so terrible that so many Jewish people were killed, and this is something that Jewish people must really have difficulty dealing with. I feel like Christians, Muslims, we could all do more, including just supporting the museum.
Right. I think getting back to G's question about how do we get the information out there, we have a physical museum in Washington, D.C. We have 1.7 million physical visitors each year, but there's so many more people that can learn about this and I think want to learn about this. So we're investing heavily in our digital platforms. Our website, our online Holocaust Encyclopedia, is visited by almost 20 million unique visitors annually. And the museum has sort of three acts. I think we're entering our third act. First was the Build It, and we have the physical museum in Washington. We became a national institution, going wherever this information is desired, and us almost sort of forcing the information and the education into to different places. And the third act is an international focus. So our website is now translated into 16 different languages. So we are we're trying to be everywhere where we know this information can make a difference.
Renee Bernberg-Silberman, Joe Silberman, Jed Silberg all here on September 9th at the Sheraton. A fabulous luncheon to support the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and all associated efforts with it. The guest speaker is Professor Deborah Lipstadt, and I assume there's links to all of it on your website?
There are, yep.
Which, again, is?
USHMM.org.
How'd you and Renee meet, Joe? And by the way, don't get this answer wrong.
This is a great question. You're opening up a whole bag of worms there, Steve.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay, so we met at Club Med in Martinique.
Oh, really?
Yep. That's a good place to meet.
Sounds like a good story to me.
It's a really good story.
Want us to go on?
Of course.
Okay.
Okay.
So I was there with a girlfriend.
Okay.
And I was sick of the whole dating scene. And here we were going to Club Med, which I didn't even know what it was when my girlfriend said we're going. I said,
I knew what it was.
I just wanted to lay on a beach.
Sure you did.
And
So it's December 8th, 1985, and it's a Sunday, and we're at the airport in Club Med, and we're at the airport at JFK Airport. And Renee, with her friend, was watching me and two of my friends hanging out, and, you know, obviously we struck, you know, some... You know, across the terminal, you know, eyesight.
You saw her, you thought she was hot, and you said, I got to get a hold of her.
Yeah, a little connection. Yeah, okay, fine, we'll get there. Yeah, we haven't gotten to Club Med yet. You know, I didn't go to meet one person. Anyway. So, we get to Club Med, and we the first night, there's a disco. We go to the disco, and I do not know why. I went up to Renee, and I asked her, hi, are your parents European? And she said...
I said, yeah. Why? Are yours?
And that just opened up an entire night of conversation. Yeah. Till 4 o'clock in the morning, we played ping pong. We talked about her family. We talked about my family. We saw incredible connections and like similarities in our upbringings.
That's goosebump stuff.
Because we're both 2Gs. We both survived these same family life cycles and life events, and we're very similar in how our upbringings were, and we just hit it off.
Well, that's one of those meant to be stories, right?
Absolutely, fate.
Yeah. Well, Renee says she was in love at first sight.
but
I can't blame
her. But not
her
necessarily
first
with you.
Well, someone.
I went back to my room and I said to my girlfriend, I'm going to marry that guy.
Oh.
Wow. Isn't that nice?
It's pretty cool. So from that moment on, when we came back from vacation, every 3 weeks we saw each other because I lived in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And Renee's from here. So literally every 3 weeks she would come out east, I would come out to Chicago, and.
Do you remember People's Express?
Sure, of course.
You could just walk
$49.
On
$49. Right.
That's what we
used.
I've never heard of that.
$49.
Yeah, those were the days.
It's a little different than the Frontier of the Spirit experience. You know, where Spirit, it's $4 to fly anywhere, but the upcharge is it's $400 to fly where you're going. Different days. I want to end at least this conversation because I know we're going to talk again about, on a positive note, and I want you to tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I think about kids now, you know, generationally. My daughter's 32. My son's 28, got a couple of grandkids. One of the great things about that generation and generations to follow is some of the labels we grew up with have fallen away. You know, if there's a kid in school that's a little different, they're not necessarily tagged as being different. Certainly there's bullying and other things that goes on, but it seems like we're getting smarter generationally. There's a lot of things we can pick on kids about, but I think we're getting better in a lot of ways. Are we getting better in regards to this topic? What would your kids say?
Well, first of all, our kids identify very clearly as grandchildren of survivors, and they were so inspired by their grandparents' stories.
You should be very proud of that.
Oh, very proud.
Very proud.
They wanted to go out and make a difference in the world. And what we find with them is they don't look at borders or lines the same way. Everybody's kind of the same to them. People are just people. Now, having said that, they come from a big city.
Sure.
They had good education. They're in big cities now, so it's easy for them to say that. But I think that when they interact with other people, they are sharing their wisdom about how you have to be tolerant of other people. Because if this woman who saved my mother's life wasn't tolerant, my mother wouldn't be here. They wouldn't be here.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think they tell the story is a way to communicate to people. You have to be open-minded towards other people.
Well, that generationally is optimistic to me because that says that, I mean, it's not perfect, obviously, but it says that we are actually headed in the right direction because when I think about the politics of today, it has to stop with younger people in the generation of today. And a lot of what we see on TV every night or hear on the radio in different places, it's the bad news because the bad news makes news. There's a lot of good news out there.
Well, I'm heartened by the kids in Florida, in Parkland, and what
Absolutely.
They've accomplished. And they went through a major tragedy in their life, and rather than just saying, oh, woe is me, I can't believe this happened to us, they went out there, and they're still going out there, and they're still, you know, talking to legislators and trying to get things accomplished. And that's what you need. You need kids, young people, who don't just talk the talk. They get out there, they talk about it, they're activists about it, they want to get their mission accomplished, and just keep going for it.
God bless them.
Relentless.
Unfortunately, they're still needed.
They are still needed. Yeah, that's probably never going
to
change.
It goes back to your question, actually, because they adopted the anthem Never Again,
mm-hmm.
which actually some survivors were upset about because Never Again was devised specifically about Jews and the Holocaust, and it would never happen to Jewish people again. But I talked about this a little bit when I was with you last time, how I think that what it really has to be is never forget. And I think never forget is a little bit more proactive than always remember.
Okay, good. Well, listen, you're the source here because you guys live this every day. And I have such respect, again, for what you do as a family, but the community in general. And I just hope more people get involved with the museum, whatever level they can.
I hope so, too. When we were just at the museum in June, and it was so heartening to see the crowds that were there to tour the museum. And it's people from all over the world. You heard all these different languages being spoken.
That's right.
You saw big family groups together. That's what we need to see. We need to see people from all over the world learning about what happened, taking away the lessons, and going forward, sharing that information with other people.
Well, see, that's what I was talking about, too. Like, my father was a World War II soldier, but I remember going to Pearl Harbor for the first time, and not with my father, but standing there with Japanese men of age who would have served for the Japanese Army, along with a bunch of, you know, older guys my father's age, who clearly would have been their enemies, and them talking to each other, understanding that we were both there, we had a job to do. It's a terrible job, but we had a job to do. And then you fast forward to the 9/11 reference I made. I'm, you know, standing in the 9/11 museum with 20-something-year-old Muslim men. There's a moment where, you know, you catch yourself, but you think, how great is this country that we live in that you can have this experience? Because those people in time, whether it be Adolf Hitler and all the others involved, all the way down to the men who took part in and executed 9/11, that's the smallest fraction of society.
From my perspective, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum is important because it gives a purpose, or at least it doesn't allow my family's deaths to go in vain.
Amen. Yeah.
So there, we're putting a, trying to get a positive spin on things and make sure that people understand what happened and never let it happen again. But even more so, we have to be educated so that we know how to treat other people, because we know what the human condition can ultimately, you know, fall into.
G, you get the last word.
Oh, just keep doing what you're doing. I think it's so important more than ever. And the passion with which you're telling your stories, I think I relate to in a totally different way. But as a first-generation immigrant, my mother survived a lot in her childhood, totally different story. But I think that's what you want to strike. You want to strike that chord of empathy and get people to think and walk in someone else's shoes. So I think your parents are very, very proud of you.
And Jed, resources locally, where do we send people?
First place to start is our website, ushmm.org. Another opportunity, if people want to get on our local mailing list, I think sending an email to midwest@ushmm.org and just ask to be subscribed. So we do this luncheon once a year. This is actually, the 24th luncheon that we're doing. But we do programming throughout the year. We bring a little bit of the museum to the Chicago area, free and open to the public. We like to do one program in the city, one program in the suburbs, and make it accessible for people. So if you're not on our mailing list, we would love to have people get there and get some information about what we're doing.
And last word from you two, outside of the dating, anything else you'd like to add before we finish?
I'll let Renee start.
Human nature can be for good or for evil. Choose the good. Make the choice to help other people. Make it a habit in your life to be good to other people. And hopefully you'll never be faced with a life or death situation. But every little thing that you do to get to know other people and help them adds light to this world, and that's what we need to continue bringing.
Well said.
My father would always say, "Thank God so far." So
I love that.
That's
I love that.
That's what we're,
because we got to get up tomorrow and do it again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Renee Bernberg Silberman, Joe Silberman, Jed Silberg, again, September 9th at the Sheraton, ushmm.org.
Yes, sir.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
We'll continue the conversation when it's appropriate for you guys. And the Steve Cochran Everything podcast, because we cover a little bit of everything here. is not all the stuff you get on the show. It's stuff that we didn't have time to get to on the show like this, longer conversation. So we're glad you listen wherever you pick up your podcasts, and we'll see you on the radio 6 to 10 Monday through Friday on 710 WGN. 720 WGN. Bye.